session number 23435, reel 4.
Dan Lindo, reel 4.
I could do about going with the task for the moment, I think, wouldn't I?
Yes. Yeah.
I've got as far as punctures. We were only allowed one spare wheel, so that, I mean, it wasn't unheard of to sit on the pavement in the middle of London mending your puncture, because there was no other way of getting home. And then when we got back, we used to have to redo them, but everybody helped out. And I think one of my worst things, I had 8 punctures in 1 week, I think, which was really overdoing it a bit. At this time, after a lot of working and hard things, I'd managed to get my front teeth done by the local dentist, the Air Force dentist, but it never was quite as good as the originals, I don't think, but anyway, it looked better, because it's a bit drafty with no front teeth, I can tell you.
Where was that done, Diana?
It was done in they had the RAF, the big station next to ours, had the proper dental place, and the RAF did it. I mean, it didn't cost me anything. But it was a proper dental. He was a dentist who had joined the Air Force, really. A lot of the doctors were all civilian doctors in civil life, you know. One of my most memorable experiences during my service years were 3 visits to the East Grinstead Hospital in Sussex, where the famous surgeon, Sir Archibald McIndoe, was the pioneer of plastic surgery. My officer, who I used to drive a lot, was the medical officer in the Balloon Command, and he was interested in plastic surgery. So we used to go down there, and he used to go and watch the operations, and I had a lot of spare time, so I used to go and talk to the many pilots and the soldiers as well, who had most fearsome burns. And I was very shocked to start off with, because they had these dreadful, dreadful burns, and they're having this plastic surgery. But they were so sort of cheerful, and eventually you got used to it, and I used to play games with them, and we used to chat about it, and the each time I went, they were a bit better. And he had, Sir Archibald had a very good scheme. He used, once they were sort of fit physically, he used to send them out on trips to London and stuff, because he thought it was good for their morale. I mean, obviously some people were a bit horrified at seeing these very scarred young men about, but they soon got used to it, and I think it gave the patients a lot of confidence that they could go into a place and they weren't really a freak, they just had these terrible burns. And he did do the most fantastic things to some of them. I mean, there'd been lots of books written about it, but I think he was an amazing man, really, really. While I was at Stanmore, and as things got a little bit quieter after the initial invasion, I used to go into London quite often on an off day and meet up with friends from Portugal. And we used to have it was quite interesting. One girl had she was in working for the BBC, and she had a party at the Overseas Club, and we met up with some of the boys from Porto who had brought along their new wives, who we met. They were all sort of married English girls, but there never seemed to be any girls taking along new husbands, so perhaps we were a bit fussier than the men. But there were 2 restaurants we used to use mostly. One was Martini's, and the other was Varaswamy's in Swallow Street. And in those days, you had a 5-shilling meal, which you just couldn't have more. That was it. And they were best because of the curry place used to have curry, and instead of rice, you had barley, but the most filling. And the Spanish place had dried cod and all sorts of Spanish dishes, which we were quite used to. So it was really a rather little bit of home, I think. But we got wonderful meals for 5 shillings, and that lasted us for a long time. By the end of August, the V1 bombs had barely stopped. Not before time, as people were getting a bit afraid of all the damage, and they did cause an enormous lot of damage. But the few leaks later, the B-2s started, and they were just as bad, except you couldn't hear them coming. We had less trips down to Kent, as the balloons were no good against the rockets, and gradually the barrage balloons were dispersed back to their original places, because they really couldn't do anything against the B-2s. Nobody could, really. The conquest of Europe was going along at quite a good pace, and we had a sort of much quieter life, which was a nice change after so much hectic stuff. And after 6 months, we finally had leave again, which was really very acceptable, because we were all extremely tired. I had a fortnight's leave, and Nora also got leave at the same time, so we spent the first week with my aunt down in Surrey having a lovely lazy time, and then for the second week we went down to Nora's house in Taunton, where we had an equally good lazy time, and came back after 2 weeks really fighting fit, because it had been a very long 6 months, and you do get awfully weary, you know. One of my trips down to the coast, we picked up a tiny puppy which had apparently been abandoned or lost or something, and it turned out, by the time I'd washed him in the sink, to be quite a nice little wire-haired terrier. I didn't know what to do with it, because I couldn't really keep him in camp, so I thought, well, I'll take him down to my aunt, I'm sure she'll love him. But she didn't, and I was at my wit's end until the local vicar came to tea. And so I said, you wouldn't he like a nice little puppy, just, it's called Buzz, I mean, lovely biblical name and all that. And much to my delight, he said, yes, he'd love to have Buzz. So Buzz joined the church and lived a very happy life at Virginia Water Church for many years. Another interesting trip I had about this time was, I went to a Q site, not far from what was then Heston Aerodrome. The Q site is a place where a couple of airmen, or perhaps a few more, live. And if there's an air raid, they light a big sort of bonfire, or a couple of bonfires in a field, supposedly to fool the bombers into thinking they've bombed something very important when they haven't. The interesting part is that the actual site, which they had all this, turned out to be Heathrow Airport. So that I really was almost set foot in the first part of Heathrow Airport all those years ago. We had an awful lot of fogs that autumn and early winter, and fogs in those days were real pea soupers. I mean, nowadays you don't really get pea soupers because of all the clean air and things, but these were really very disorientating, and you really couldn't see anywhere. And I remember once I was in London with one of my officers, and we were trying to get back to Stanmore, and sort of tooting, we thought, sort of going along Hammersmith, and we saw a bus in front, so I thought, we'd better follow the bus, it must be going somewhere. So we followed the bus, because the lights were still fairly dim in those days, and we ended up in Stamford Brook bus station, much to the amusement of all the buses. But anyway, they eventually put us onto the North Circular Road, and we got home, but it was really, you just literally couldn't see anything, and it's a very nasty feeling not being able to know where you are at all.
By this time, the blackout rules would have relaxed, wouldn't they?
Yes, they were better. We were allowed to take off the little sort of stripy things, and but you still couldn't see very far, because the lights were very dim, but it was certainly better. But there weren't any street lights or anything. You did have the odd house light. I mean, you weren't sort of thrown into jail for having lights showing, you know. And in October, suddenly, all of a sudden, I was awarded a good conduct stripe, which was somewhat amazing. And as my uncle said, a lot of undetected crime must have gone on. But anyway, it looked rather good on my sleeve. And it's really like a corporal stripe worn upside down, down the bottom of your sleeve. And you get it if you serve 3 years of undetected crime. But anyway, it looked good.
Would you like to talk about Christmas 44?
Yes, Christmas in 1944, we rather hoped that it was going to be the last Christmas, but you know, you can't be sure of these things. But for the first time in 3 years, I was able to have my lunch down in Virginia Water with the family, which was great because I hadn't been down there for lunch really properly at all. I had to sort of get back on Christmas night, but I thought, well, I'll go and have a good lunch. So anyway, I went down, and it was fairly austere, but I would manage to take a few things down from the cookhouse, and everybody produced some spirits, and we really had a good time, and some of my cousins were at home. So the contributions were varied and many. The only problem was that my moped was having one of its off days, so I'd had to go down by train. And going back, there was a strike of all the bus drivers and the train drivers. So that, and the buses and tube drivers, the train was all right, I got to Waterloo, but after that, no idea how I was going to get to Stanmore. But anyway, a few sort of hitchhikes and things I managed, and I arrived back probably a bit late, but nobody seemed to mind as there was dance going on. But even in those days, they had strikes at inconvenient times. Towards the end of 1944, the worker balloon command came to an end, and the government decided that there was no more danger of air raids and low-level attacks. The disbanding was really rather disheartening because I'd been in balloon command for nearly 4 years, although not involved in the balloons, but we got to know all the people in it. And a lot of the officers had been in the RFVR before the war, and they were sort of going to be out on their ears, really. It was decided that there would be a final parade at Balloon Command in Stanmore, so we all got ready with cleaning the place up and taking our officers around other camps to sort of say goodbye and stuff. And on February the 5th, the official disbanding of the Balloon Command took place. Everything was polished, and the people from all over Britain came from various sites to parade, and the RAF band and the WAF band, and Sir Archibald Sinclair, who was the Air Minister, came to take the salute. And we had a fairly busy day because we used to take people to the station, but it was really quite moving, and this huge parade of over 1,000 people marching, and the half-deflated balloon at the back is really rather sad, but they'd done a jolly good job in spite of what everybody might have said.
Did you find yourself feeling a bit emotional at
that
time?
Yes, it was really, because, I mean, it had always been known as a spare force, which was unfair, really, and it was a jolly hard job, but there really wasn't any point in it going on if there weren't going to be any more raids, and so all the people were remustered to other commands, and I mean, I'm sure they were quite happy to be remustered, but a lot of them had lived on these isolated sites, and they'd become really great friends, you know, and it was quite sort of like splitting up a family, really, I think.
At that time, were you busy ferrying VIPs around?
Yes, well, during the actual parade, we acted like a sort of taxi service between the tube station and the RAF station. But it wasn't very far, it's just so that they could go back to where they were going. A lot of them, of course, came in staff cars and things, and we entertained their drivers. But it all seemed to go off very smoothly. We had actually a very nice AOC at Balloon Command, and he, after this was all disbanded and before he was sent somewhere else, he decided he'd like to have a weekend off at the Wheatsheaf Hotel in Virginia Water. And his wife came up from the West Country. And he called me in and he said, I know you live down in Virginia Water, would you like to drive me down and you could have a weekend off and picnic, bring me back on Sunday? So I said, that's great, thank you very much. So there we were, polished up the AOC's car with the flags flying, sailed down to Virginia Water, and I dropped him off at the Wheatsheaf, and he said, well, pick me up at 5 o'clock on Sunday. So I said, okay, so. And I went to my aunt's house, and the next day it turned out she was having a lunch party, or small lunch party, and the people were coming down by train from London. So I said, right, I'll go and pick them up in the AOC's car. I'm sure he won't mind. So I sailed down to the station and picked them up in this rather smart car. And as we were driving back, who should I pass going down to the station on foot with the AOC? So I thought, oh dear. But anyway, so I took them back to my aunt's house and rushed off back down to the station to rescue him, and I apologised profusely, and he said he really was very good about it. He just thanked me for going to rescue him, so I was able to help him as well, but he was very good about it, because it could have been quite nasty, really, for him. So that, and then I had a very nice weekend, and I picked him up, and we went home. He was a very, very nice man.
How did things continue at camp?
Well, it was really sort of depressing a bit, because it was all sort of wrapping up everything. A lot of people were posted to other camps, and the sort of skeleton staff was left at Stanmore to do the accounts, because an awful lot of paperwork. Nora was sort of posted down to London. But just before this happened, in the middle of April, I was whisked into hospital with acute appendicitis. So that the hospital was at Red Hill, which was Edgware, not Red Hill in Surrey. And so everybody had to be informed. My aunt came up to see me, and Nora was packed my bag so I could bring my things to the hospital. But I had this operation. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. Felt very sorry for myself, but after that I was given a leave, and they drove me down to Surrey to spend leave with my aunt and uncle. And of course, all this happened just about VE Day, so that I was just got to gone on leave, having felt better when VE Day arrived. And of course, I wasn't allowed to do anything except look on, because I was still sort of fairly feeble, I think. But luckily, most of my cousins were home on leave. And I was very useful at dispensing prairie oysters and hangover pills, I think. I was allowed to go and watch the dancing, but I wasn't allowed to take part.
The appendicitis problem came on with acute pain, did it?
Mm. Yes, I'd had sort of the old twinges that I didn't think about. I thought I'd eaten something or something, but it just suddenly sort of struck me, and I really felt extremely unwell. But it's always done quite quickly, you know. I was whizzed in with an ambulance and stuff. And while I was in the hospital, before I went on leave, I was posted to 11 Fighter Group at Uxbridge, which was just down the road from Stanmore. But I was quite pleased, really, because it was getting a bit boring at Stanmore, and Nora had been posted to Air Ministry in London. And so that I'd sort of rather lost heart at Stanmore. So after my leave, I went back to Stanmore to collect all my papers and stuff, and persuaded them to drive me over to Uxbridge, and began my final stint at 11 Fighter Group, which was at the top end of Uxbridge Camp. Uxbridge is a huge camp, and the top part was called Hillingdon, was the 11 Fighter Group, which was extremely well known and had been very busy during the Battle of Britain, when all the fighters all around London were commanded from there.
You knew all about it at that time, did you?
About what?
The 11 Fighter Group.
Yes, it was well known as being one of the main groups during the Battle of Britain, and all the fighters, all the stations around London had all been bossed around by them. And a lot of the fighter aces were doing desk jobs in the Uxbridge, which they didn't like very much, but they'd done their stint and they were then grounded. So that it was quite a nice place to be, actually, because the MT section lived in a little sort of bungalow at the entrance to the camp, up in the top part, and the rest of the staff lived down in the big camp. So we were really quite lucky, although we went down to the big camp for cinema and all that sort of stuff.
Did you have a regular boyfriend around this time?
No, I didn't, actually. I had sort of various. My engagement had fizzled out, but there wasn't anybody that was mainly sort of attached to, I don't think. We usually went out in the sort of groups, you know, I mean, but Nora and I went out a lot together because she was now stationed in London and living in a bedsitter in this talk Baker Street. And she decided that it would be a good idea if we set up house together. But as I was still stationed at Uxbridge, I didn't think this was possible. Anyway, I went and asked if I could have a sleeping out pass, which they said no, I couldn't. So I thought, well, it's only just a tube ride away. So I went down to London on one of my days off, and Nora and I finally found quite a nice bed-sitting room just off Baker Street, which she needed anyway. And it had two beds, and it had a bathroom which you could use, and a little sort of kitchenette. So we decided we'd take this, and I would take the risk of coming down when I could. So we set up house, and my aunt and her mother produced all sorts of saucepans and stuff. And it was really, we had great fun down there.
Did you see the fighter aces as sort of glamorous figures? Did you try to get to know them?
Well, when you're sort of a lowly aircraftswoman, or leading aircraftswoman, if you like, you don't really mix with the officers. I mean, John Cunningham, who was the leading night fighter ace, he was there. I used to drive him. And there were several others we all knew by name. But, I mean, you know, I think you just treat them as people. You don't sort of... They'd had all the glamour already, you know, and they were very nice, most of them.
The thing is, when you're driving someone, well, when you're with someone in a car, very often there is conversation, and it can be almost like peer counselling sometimes when you're, you know, with someone in a car. Would you have had any experience of that? You know, the, say, John Cunningham talking to you at length about anything?
Well, he particularly is a very reticent fellow, but it is interesting that if you were driving RAF officers, they practically sat in the front with you if there was one. If you were driving WAF officers, they always sat in the back. But, I mean, if there were two, they were sat in the back. But WAF officers very seldom sat in the front. But we all used to chat, you know. I mean, they used to, quite often they were doing paperwork, but we all had our favourites, and we got to know them quite well on duty, not off duty, on duty. So we chatted about family things and what they were going to do on their leave, and it was really sort of friendly, you know.
So they wouldn't have ever talked about serious stuff?
Oh, not really. I mean, never. I think they quite enjoyed being off, sort of not on duty, really. I mean, the WAF officers were very silent. They used to be doing paperwork. They were not very nice to drive, really. As some of the aces there, I mean, Group Captain John Cunningham was there, Wing Commander Rawlinson, who had been his observer, and several Polish aces, including Wing Commander Zulikowski. And they took every opportunity to fly somewhere if they could, but were often forced to travel by car rather to their disgust. The group covered a huge area, most of South East England and up into East Anglia, and if they could fly, we used to drive them to Northolt Airport, and they used to get in the plane, and we had nothing to do for the rest of the day till they came back again. But I did speak to a group captain Cunningham once, and I said it was very boring doing this, but he liked to go by car for a change, and he did change his mind once or twice. But the section at Uxbridge was the biggest I'd been in. There were about 20 girls and 8 men. And towards the end of the, I suppose it was 45, quite a lot of the married WAFs started getting demobbed or going off to be demobbed. So there was a bit more work to do, which was like, it had been a bit boring because there were too many drivers and not enough cars and things. And I had played quite a lot of cricket because when I went there, the WAP officer asked if I played cricket, so I thought, yes, well, the afternoon off I did. And we had great fun. We had quite a good cricket team, which was coached by a RAF corporal who had been a minor cricket player. And we played quite a lot of other stations. We did rather well, actually. He was quite proud of us, I think. And also, one of the bonuses was that as I was appointed a captain, it was quite a thing to be able to order around all the two-wife officers who were in the field any time I could, so, but they were very good about it.
What was your outfit? Did you play in skirts?
Yeah, no, the Air Force gave us a uniform. We had white skirts and white shirts and white sleeveless pullovers with RAF colours around them. Very smart indeed, actually. And white sort of plimsolls, I suppose. And white socks. No, they were really made sure we looked professional. And they gave us, I mean, we had the transport, RAF transport, when we went and played other teams and things, but we had a lot of fun and we really became quite good. We had a demon bowler who could almost kill you if she got him in the right place.
Were you an all-rounder?
I was usually the wicket-keeper, actually, but I could bowl. I had played quite a lot of cricket when I was at school and also out in Porto in the holidays, so I mean, I could play, but I quite like being the wicket-keeper because you can see what's going on. You don't have to run about so much.
Did you continue playing cricket after the war?
Vaguely, not a lot. They've always had cricket in the Porto, and we used to have sort of mothers and sons thing. Not they didn't have a sort of proper team out there. Yeah.
You were driving Group Captain Cunningham around. Can you recall where?
Well, not really. I mean, it was all over the place. We used to drive up to East Anglia a bit. He really used to visit some of his old fighter stations, and because he'd been a night fighter pilot for many years. And I can't remember really where we did go. I mean, up in East Anglia and Essex and things mostly, I think we went.
And you would have been seeing aircraft at close quarters?
Well, not yes, up to a point, but usually when we drove officers to flying airfields, we were sort of parked in the empty section waiting for our officers. We didn't really see much going on. But yes, occasionally we saw an evening. I did go up with Group Captain Cunningham once. He took me up in a mosquito, I think it was, which was quite fun.
But it was a marvellous experience. Can you just describe the whole experience?
Well, you get terribly blasé, you know, actually, when you see so many aeroplanes, but it was fast, and we sort of flew up sort of one side of it and then down the middle. But you don't see a lot at that speed, you know, it was just going quite fast, the mosquito. But it was an experience anyway, but I'm not a tremendous fan of flying anyway. Some of the camps you went to were huge great American bases up in East Anglia, mostly in Norfolk, and they were sort of, they'd taken over a lot of the bomber command station, and they had these huge great places. And if I would sort of take an officer up there, he was doing his stuff and I was off, and it was really quite an experience. You used to eat in their mess. You've never seen the food. There were tinned peaches and tinned everything. Absolutely wonderful food. We hadn't seen for about 8 years. And they were very generous too. They used to give us stockings and lots of cigarettes. And we used to come home full of tinned food and things. But they were very good. And they've still got the two great big bases in East Anglia now. And they sort of continued from where they left off, I think.
Can you recall what happened on VJ Day?
Well, it's a little tricky, really. Well, VJ Day was on the August the 8th, and we'd heard rumours about it for a few days beforehand, but I was quite determined, as I'd been off on the sick list during VE Day, that I was going to enjoy VJ Day. But we were absolutely astounded at the pictures of the devastation of the atom bombs, and we could hardly believe it when it was made official that the war had come to an end, because quite frankly I wasn't too keen on celebrating VE Day when there was still fighting going on in the Far East, but now VJ Day was really over and we could all go mad. It was actually amazing when we were all given 2 days off. Not necessarily all at once, because of course somebody had to be on duty. And I got VJ plus one and two off. They would be all celebrated in the camp if you were on duty. But the next day, one of the chaps and I decided we'd go into town and really see what it was like. Because I hadn't... in those days you didn't have television, so you couldn't see all the crowds. So we set off on VJ plus one into London, and we took, well, full of quite a lot of money and hoping for the best. And we arrived in London. It was absolutely...